You're listening to Climate Champions, a podcast from the Architects Journal. I'm Hattie Hartman, sustainability editor at the Architects Journal. Welcome to this new series on materials, timed with the publication of a book I've edited for RIBA Publishing called Materials, an Environmental Primer. I'm joined for this series by a new co-host, Joe Jack Williams, partner and sustainability lead at Field & Clegg Bradley Studios. Joe has been my co-editor for the book. I'd also like to do a shout out to my previous co-host, George Morgan of 1.5 Architecture, for a fantastic run of 46 episodes of Climate Champions. We conceived this podcast together during lockdown. Thank you, George. I couldn't have done it without you. Now, on to materials.
It's incredibly important to have a holistic approach when selecting building products, particularly the iconic building materials, the ones that when people go home after having been in the building, they'll remember. How does it convey the client's values? What are potential ethical challenges? Is it sourced properly? Was there no child labor involved? Was there no irresponsible forest harvesting? You have to be really, really clean on all these issues.
Our guest today is Martha Lewis of Copenhagen practice Henning Larsen. Martha joined Henning Larsen over 20 years ago, and she took on the role of head of materials in 2018. If every large architectural practice had someone in this role, the profession would be better prepared to tackle climate emergency. Martha's interest in materials started with a focus on health and toxicity, and now extends to planetary health as well. She has led the development of Henning Larsen's Unboxing Carbon database, open source on the practice's website. I urge you to have a look. You'll find it at the bottom of the homepage. For example, there are over 20 types of brick presented with an image and an embodied carbon figure. Martha has developed a course for architects on the embodied carbon of materials that she teaches in a workshop format, not only across Henning Larsen's 700-strong designers, but to external practices as well. It's both engaging and informative. We should all go on this course. We're lucky to have Martha with us today. Martha, I'd like to start by asking you to describe your role at Henning Larsen. How did you start, and how has your role evolved over the years?
I've now been at Henning Larsen for 20 years, and I initially started working on projects in a role where I was very deeply involved in material selection. So I worked on parts of projects that were iconically present with their material selection, the auditoriums, the lobbies, the main meeting rooms, where materials really express the values of the client. After about 8 years of doing that role, I was working on the new Spiegel headquarters in Hamburg on Hafen City. And I worked very closely with the engineers because we needed to fulfill a new certification system that had been developed specifically for Hafen City. So this certification had a very interesting point in it. We were asked to screen for and to control the public resources. And the automatic thought was water, but another aspect of it were the chemical impacts from the building products. So that was then not just looked at through the lens of the user in the room, which is the way many people have thought about health impacts, but with a wider lens. So looking at what are the impacts to the environment. So this was a really interesting approach to product selection, where we had to do some screening and investigation to see what is in the building products. And this just opened up, back in 2008, a whole new world for me, where I had not really understood how much information you could pull out if you really did want to find it. And you just had to ask the right questions.
I mean, I think that's fascinating that you came to it because of a building standard. And I know the Hafen City work was really interesting, and certainly DGNB and how they're sitting together. How are you finding that interaction, finding that data at those early stages?
We were relied very heavily on the engineers for our final screening. But in 2008, I think we were certainly very aware of the PVC challenges. The polyvinyl chloride was really a no-go, but that it went further to brominated fire retardants, for example, and that there were also floor products that we really shouldn't be having in our buildings. That we relied more on the engineers because they had the chemical, the toxicological background that I certainly don't have.
I just wondered, obviously your unboxing carbon work is fantastic. What was the kind of transition from sort of healthy materials into sort of embodied carbon? Is it a kind of just an iteration or?
It really has become a bit of a dichotomy. Is it chemicals or is it CO2 impacts that should be the basis for our decision for healthy and an environmentally less negative product selection process? I am an American. I was trained as an architect in the US and came out of the American approach to material selection and have a very early LEED accredited professional certification. But I've been working in Europe since the 90s. And it's been very interesting watching this particular dichotomy develop in the two continents because in the States, the concern with materials has been for a longer period of time than in Europe, a question of health and a question of what is in our products and what can we do to minimize the problematic chemical content and how can we have more transparency? So I've been very much influenced by trends in the States in terms of keeping a very sharp eye on what is in our building products and how can we demand to have more knowledge about this from manufacturers. And in Europe, the focus in terms of materials where people got really much more activated and much more interested in making environmentally correct decisions has been through LCA, life cycle assessment, and looking at global warming potential from materials. So I have seen it as a natural task for myself to simply integrate what is the focus in the States with material selection and what is the focus in Europe.
That's so interesting. I hadn't articulated that to myself in that way. I always knew that this healthy materials thing was going on in the States and that LCA was prevalent here, but I hadn't realized there was this dichotomy on opposite sides of the pond.
I think part of the discrepancy is that in the States, there was a very strong need for having an NGO type organization or an academic organization take over this role because the government simply wasn't stepping in the way that we have the European Chemical Agency and we have REACH initiative from 2006, and we have the candidate list with the substance of very high concern. So I think that there's a perception in Europe that we're covered. We have a very active chemical agency that is putting regulations legislatively in place, and so we don't need to think about that. It's not entirely true, but more on that a little bit later.
Do you think it's changed much? I'm thinking back, I'm thinking about Declare labels from Living Building Challenge, and you mentioned healthy product declarations, and now we've got environmental product declarations. Do you think they're all going to start to come together? Is that where you see it sort of heading towards? And do you think this sort of wash of data is, I mean, it can be quite daunting for a new architect. All of a sudden, it's a whole raft of other things you've got to think about. But how do you see it sort of progressing?
That's a great challenge of our time. There's a glut of information, and how do we navigate too much information in order to make the right decisions? One of the things I've been working on is Danish or European-based material passport for product declarations. One of the most interesting things is that when we go out and do surveys to ask people, What is it you'd like to see in a material passport? The answer is pretty consistently. We'd like to see information about circularity, we'd like to see content information, but nearly everyone says we'd like to see the global warming potential. Now, you actually have an existing declaration, an environmental product declaration, an EPD that has this data in it already. So there's a strong thirst to have this located in one document, that the future is a consolidation of the most relevant data that we need in order to make our decisions. So we need to have the global warming potential, we need to have this carbon emissions information, we also need to have the content, and we need to know a lot more about what the manufacturer thinks is the future resource potential for the product.
That would be amazing. I mean, it sounds ambitious and it doesn't sound like it's going to happen tomorrow, but it would certainly transform decision making and make it so much easier. So let's talk for a moment about unboxing carbon. It's a very intuitive way of conveying the hidden impacts of material choices. Can you describe it for our listeners?
Yes, the Unboxing Carbon workshop and course was something that came out of my deeply felt desire to have architects simply have more knowledge. We're coming into a development where buildings need to have a whole life building life cycle assessment calculation in order for it to get a building permit, for example, in Denmark. It's part of the building code. You have to do this. And early on, I saw that there could be a danger as many of these product-related and material-related processes or services, as they become more specialized and more technological in a sense, that the consultants also have to increase their knowledge. And I was really worried that the material selection would land over on the engineer's desk, where it shouldn't be. I had a vested interest in getting architects up to speed so that the architectural services could deliver life cycle assessment and chemical screening. I still am working on this because I think it's really important that we raise our level of knowledge, that knowledge bar, so that we can do life cycle assessment and we keep this process very close to the design process, separating it, sending it out to outsource this really important design process is a no-go as far as I see design development. So that was the task I gave myself. How is it that we can make this more accessible to architects, and part of that process simply simplifying and starting at a level where you meet the architects, and that was really easy for me. You just hand them a box of materials. You know, you open the box, it's like Christmas morning. You open this box and you get all these things. You can pack it out. You can see, oh, here's this lovely piece of cork, and doesn't it smell great? And yeah, and oh, it's been in this box for a couple of months, but it still smells like cork, and you can still smell your way into what is this material. And we have all sorts of things in the box. I have about 20 different materials. And the box is part of the first workshop in the course after a lecture, where the architects, without any data, do an intuitive response to unboxing carbon. And it's an intuitive assessment of where on a global warming potential line, from the least amount to the most amount of global warming potential per square meter of this particular material in this thickness that's in the box. So you go into a group and you discuss, and there are lots of people come with various ranges of knowledge, but everyone can do a line by the end of the half hour, and then we talk about it. And the next part of the course is it's a little bit more technical, but we kind of spring it on them gently. So they have to read an EPD and understand how you read an EPD and pull out data. So essentially, you're taking a really dumb and thick and technically heavy and small print and lots of numbers and just overwhelming data heavy EPD, and by the end of the course, you've pulled out like a picture of the material, or you found a better picture online, and then you have the essential data. What is the CO2 impacts per square meter in a particular thickness and with a particular density, and who's the manufacturer, and a little description of the product? Much more accessible for an architect.
Does this make sense to you, Joe? Because Joe is in this role in his practice.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. And just to give a shout out for the document, A, it's fantastic. And B, the fact that it's open and free and people can engage with it just on your website, even without going through your course, I think it's a really beneficial thing. I think that knowledge sharing's just essential. And you know, the workshop sounds fantastic. I think I'd get quite a bit from even just sitting through the workshop, even though I've spent 2 or 3 years just thinking about materials in a book. I just wonder, you talked about architects sort of owning it. Is there a case for educating other groups as well? I'm thinking perhaps maybe not in the design team, maybe it's the kind of client team and the people who are procuring it. You know, have you had much interaction with them in your course?
The interesting thing with the Unboxing Carbon course was that we initially did this course for everyone at Henning Larsen. And so we ran this course between 20, 35 times in-house. And at a certain point, two things were clear. One, this is really working. And two, Henning Larsen can sell this course to other architecture offices. And three, that we could drive really interesting client discussions by introducing the workshop in a client meeting. So you're right on target there, Joe, because we did, and we have continued to use this in client discussions. It's an eye-opener, particularly for clients who are interested but simply don't know where to start.
What about some of the wider sustainability impacts of materials beyond carbon and beyond the kind of health issues that may be less well understood, such as biodiversity or some of the social impacts? How do you suggest that designers get to grip with these?
I feel it's incredibly important to have a holistic approach when selecting building products, particularly the iconic building materials that, for example, the facade cladding or the flooring in your lobby, the ones that when people go home after having been in the building, they'll remember, oh yeah, there was this really rich red something, or when we walked across the floor, it was just so smooth, and that give a sensual, something that lives with the person after they've left the project. So those materials, those iconic materials, it's especially important to have a very knowledgeable background when you make that decision, and to take all of your possible options up on the table and do essentially a material matrix, decision matrix, where you look at the cost of the product, you look at the architectural expression, how does it convey the client's values, what are potential ethical challenges with this, is it sourced properly? Can we document that it is sourced properly? Was there no child labor involved? Was there no irresponsible forest harvesting, for example? All of this, you have to be really, really clean on all these issues. And then that's also overlaid with other parameters, health parameters. Like what are the off-gassing? What is the chemical content of the material? And what is the end of life scenario? Does this have to be sent to be stored in a salt mine in Norway at the end of its life? Or can you send it into a new circle? And then you also have the environmental, which overlap a bit with the health. So you have your CO2 and other, we have so focused on global warming potential. I think we forget that there are other parameters in a life cycle assessment. We are really trying to crack the CO2 nut before we begin to understand those other parameters. So it's really at the moment boiled down to global warming potential. Your architectural expression is really important. You're not going to choose something that fulfills, checks all the other boxes, but isn't what you want to express. So everything needs to be working for you.
I totally agree with what you say. You could have a kind of hierarchy, I suppose. The most important let's call them iconic materials in a building, perhaps need more in-depth scrutiny than others. But all of this becomes a lot more work for architects as part of the design process.
It does. And I think that I used to be a lot more nuanced about it and really emphasize the holistic aspect and investigate all the way around and then make your decision. And today I feel like that's shifted a bit because I think that you shouldn't even bring certain things onto the table for discussion. You shouldn't even put them into your selection matrix unless they meet certain criteria, because I really think we have to prioritize health impacts and environmental impacts. That we need to start there and to get everything that you're looking at to fulfill a basic datum on health and a basic datum on a baseline on environmental impacts and on health impacts.
Within your projects, is it about having the conversation around the materials and the kind of compromises you have to make? You know, is there a low carbon material that's slightly less healthy compared to a healthy material that's slightly higher carbon? Or, you know, how do you kind of navigate that discussion, I suppose, about prioritizing and, you know, the ethics of material selection?
You often meet what the Danes call pest or cholera choices, where perhaps it has a really high global warming potential, and then it also has something in its contents, and then it's then you just say, okay, we're not going to take that. But if you have one that's really good on global warming performance, but has chemical content that you don't want, that's where you have a hard time with the decisions. And then I always return to, okay, where is it actually used in the building? Now, is this really a problem? Should we be using wood on the facade cladding? Are we problematizing something that's good because of how we're using it? So there are always more questions to ask. It's not an easy dialogue, but you just have to keep working at it until you find the product that actually does land well on all aspects of what you're looking at. And yeah, you need a lot more knowledge to do that. And you need more time, and it is more costly, which is why I think these open source knowledge sharing is really essential. And I'm so glad to see that many others are also doing this, because we have to be quicker about getting this knowledge. It can't be a whole research project to figure out what's going on with this material.
That's a perfect segue into my next question, which is about your role in the practice. How do you feed this knowledge into projects? At what point and how often? And is there more than just you working on this? Henning Larsen is a very large practice.
We have a whole life cycle assessment team, and they're really sharp about material selection. So if designers are looking at a particular exterior wall construction versus three other alternatives, they can do the calculations, and then the designers have a much more informed basis to move forward. We are also working on unboxing chemicals, so that I hope that we have raised the bar of knowledge on chemicals and building products also. We're not quite ready with the course yet, but this is the next unboxing that I think has to happen, where it's presented on an approachable, simplified level for architects, and then before they know it, we get them up and running at a much more complex level. But in terms of projects, it depends, of course, on where I come in on the project. Right now, I'm working on a brief on the program for a large urban planning project that will have various different new and transformation projects in it. And that's just heaven for me, because then you can roll out all sorts of ambitions, and the client is very receptive to a very high level of ambition in the sustainability section of the briefs. I can be very much involved in the early stages, where the client is saying, well, how do I keep a high level all the way through? And then we have to look at various different certification systems. Most of them, I'm not, never satisfied, because they simply just don't to deliver the whole thing. So I'm somewhat critical of all of the certification systems out there, and I'm always trying to come with, well, if you do this, then maybe you could also voluntarily put this into the requirements for the project, because then it would be more sustainable. It's really hard. The best way to keep sustainable ambitions all the way through the project is to certify them. There is really nothing that is quite as heavy-handed as that certification that comes at the end.
Are there particular certifications, if just thinking about just materials, that you sort of recommend or lean into more than others?
It's a loaded territory. There's so much. And in a Danish context, this is a very local certification system, but the SWAN on a building level is very good for materials. You have the chemical content, no carcinogenic, mutagenic, reprotoxic substances in building products, as well as other aspects. And this is simply a prerequisite. I think Living Building Challenge has some very admirable elements, particularly for materials.
I find it quite interesting that you still lean on certifications to make sure that there's a kind of push through the project to make sure it's achieved.
I think the certification system we need right now should be planetary boundaries based. And I think we need to have an incredibly strong eye on biodiversity, on pollution, and on reducing impacts on the climate crisis. And none of the systems live up to that.
That is exactly what we concluded in our book. Here in the UK, ACAN, the Architects Climate Action Network, has been very active in working on Kate Raworth's donut economics, and they tried to take EPDs and donut economics and cross them together and say, we need to be looking at all these things, and there's a lot to look at. That's why I think your approach of picking the most important materials in a project is one place to start. We can't do everything, and we have to start somewhere.
I think in all of our discussions about materials, we have to remember that it's not just about choosing the right material with the low health impact and the low environmental impact. Like, where is that product going to be used? Are you using it because you've just taken down part of a forest to build a new headquarters? You can't justify anything by good material selection at that point. And so the initial questions of where we are building are much more relevant. Of course, you have to have the right materials, but it seems like that's not like the driver in this. You really need to be making these base decisions about where and or are you reusing a building? Are you taking even taking agricultural land for new development? I think is a dubious proposition. We have to be much more cautious about our resources, and now I'm not speaking about the resources of our materials, but resources on a site scale. So I don't always have only material glasses on. I think you have to be much broader than that.
So what would you say is the main focus of what you're working on at the moment, Martha? It sounds like you have your fingers in a lot of pies.
Actually, the research I'm doing at the moment is looking into statistics for usage of chemicals in Denmark, in the Nordics, and to try and bust a few assumptions. So I have all sorts of fabulous data about what's being used, what use category these substances are being used in, and I've done mappings with.
What would be an example of this?
For example, you can see the tons of usage of formaldehyde, and then you can see, okay, formaldehyde is used in eight different building-related use categories. It's used in adhesives and sealants. It's used in fillers. It's used in insulation material. It's used in building products. My interest in this was actually to come down to the certification schemes. Well, we have a DGNB in Denmark, and they have a very complex criteria called ENV 1.2. And in this criteria, you're asked as a consultant or a contractor to do an enormous amount of work to try and figure out is this product compliant with DGNB's requirements or not. And so everyone uses a huge amount of time on this. And then at the end, they feel like they have like the cleanest building in the world. And I was a little bit curious, like, well, are they actually screening for the chemicals that are the problematic chemicals that are in use in Denmark? And the result of that was that no, they're not. So that's what I'm looking at now. And just on a wider level, I'm looking very closely at REACH, which is the regulative arm of the European Chemical Agency. Bust some people's assumption that, well, REACH is protecting me. I'm fine because I live in Europe and everything's okay. It's not the case. PFAS. I'm working right now on a PFAS and other chemicals and microplastics and off-gassing and CO2 impacts of paint. So a paint project working together with the Danish Consumer Testing Agency, looking very specifically at paints that consumers use. Also, to be able to hand to architects or to hand to people who paint their child's room, don't use this. We've done some investigations. Use this instead. And then to get this information out there, I'm a big fan of getting the information out, using science, using knowledge, and then delivering so people can make better choices.
I saw that you recently joined the board of a Hamburg-based material data platform called ReValue, dedicated to greater material transparency. What is that all about?
Well, this is another fabulous initiative that if you're an architect, you definitely should know about it. It's online. They're actually based with one leg in Scandinavia and one leg on the continent in coming out of Germany. The data is, after my own heart, presented in a very graphically appealing way so that it speaks to architects. Images of products and very simplified data. What is the global warming potential per unit of this particular product? So it is taking EPD data and delivering it in a very digestible form. And I think they're doing fabulous work. And this is open source, so you can just dial it up online.
You're obviously working with, you've spoken a lot about designers and architects, you've spoken about clients. You sounds like you're engaging with certification bodies. I wonder if you could just talk about how you've been received by sort of manufacturers, and have you had much take from that kind of discussion on that side?
It depends what the manufacturer. In this work, we have had very strong support from certain manufacturers who really are interested in transparency, working very openly in terms of what are the contents, where are they sourcing from, when they land on potential problematic substances, what could they substitute? I mean, there's a driving incentive to optimize the product and to make it less impactful in terms of environmental and health impacts as possible. So there are lots of manufacturers who are very proactive and very supportive of the material pass work. And we are also have over the years confronted many manufacturers who are less willing to be open and are less willing to support transparency. So one of the things that helps all of this in terms of the manufacturers is that the EU legislation really is becoming more aggressive. So there has been 2 years ago, the SKIBS database was established for declaration. So we're having a lot of support from the legislative arm, and that's very encouraging. It's very interesting with the material passport. 8 years ago, there was huge resistance, and now we meet a Danish industry that says, well, it's not really a question of whether there should be a material passport. It's a question of what is asked of manufacturers. And I think even that last question is becoming more clear based on the frameworks from the EU.
Well, it's all going in the right direction, but unfortunately, we're not in the EU anymore. So, just one more question, Martha. What have you got in the pipeline that you're most excited about?
Well, I'd say this paint project that will come out. We're also pursuing funding to have a closer look at PFAS in a Danish context. I've also just said goodbye to a lovely colleague who worked with me on Unboxing Carbon because she's starting a PhD looking at biodiversity metrics, how to get these off-site biodiversity impacts into life cycle analysis. So that is in its infancy, but I think that we need it.
That is a huge topic. I was at a conference yesterday all about that very question, and that issue is enormous and complicated, and we need to act quickly before it's too late.
I am looking forward to launching Unboxing Chemicals later this year so that we can begin to be smarter about our choices and have a better understanding of the chemicals we need to be avoiding and how to do that.
That sounds like a very useful tool. So I wanted to ask you one last question. Was there a light bulb moment when you became aware of the planetary crisis and the need to shift architectural practice? When did that start with you?
I come out of a tradition from childhood where my mom had Diet for a Small Planet on the bookshelf, and we were very conscious of what we consumed and whether we were eating beef or whether we were eating lentils. So this has always been a part of my life since before I can remember. My parents gave that to me.
Thank you very much, Martha. What a great conversation. A lot of food for thought. I think we could easily go on for another hour.
Yeah, fantastic. Really, really enjoyable. Thanks, Martha.
Our next guest will be Eva McNamara of Expedition Engineering on the thorny topic of concrete. You can find the show notes for this episode at www.architectsjournal.co.uk/podcasts, where you can also catch up with all our previous episodes. If you're enjoying Climate Champions, please subscribe and do rate us on your favorite podcast platform. It helps people find us. Thanks.